There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
But Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. He turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. This show is all about President Trump's extensive and complicated legal issues. They bring up really good questions about free speech and defamation and whether Michael Avenatti is a good lawyer and whether Michael Avenatti is a good bankruptcy lawyer and whether the president can be sued or forced to testify while in office. It was clear we needed to devote some time each week to answering some of these big legal questions. So I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popat.com. He hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
Before we get to Wednesday's sentencing hearing with Amy Berman Jackson, can we talk about the sentence that came down last week from Judge Ellis that I think people found quite surprising? Just 47 months for Paul Manafort, even though the sentencing guidelines called for 19 to 24 years in prison for him. Why did Ellis give him such a light sentence?
Well, I've described it as something that was surprising but not shocking. The guideline range was much higher than the typical white-collar criminal. And this is the type of case where federal judges are known to go a long way away from the guidelines, which they can do because there aren't mandatory minimum sentences for white-collar crime, the where they are for drugs and guns and that type of thing. So I think Judge Ellis just had a sort of visceral feeling that 19 years was ridiculous and something more like 4 years was more appropriate. There are all sorts of things wrapped up in a judge's gut reaction. Part of it is self-perpetuating, that we give white-collar criminals lower sentences, therefore lower sentences are appropriate for this guy. But despite the sort of the hot take of the day, I don't take it as a huge political bias. I see it more as sort of what lawyers sometimes call black robe fever, the judicial belief that they're sort of they know best about everything.
Why shouldn't people read a political bias into it? I mean, throughout the case, he signaled displeasure with the broader special counsel enterprise, that he thought that Mueller's probe was overbroad. And obviously, he doesn't get to sit in judgment of the whole probe, but this is what he does get to sit in judgment of. And where he had the opportunity, he handed down a much smaller sentence than Mueller presumably wanted.
Well, I think you can certainly see political bias and distaste for the prosecution as a factor, but I think it would be too simplistic to see it as the main or driving factor. There are a lot of things coming together here. One of them is, again, the fact that white-collar criminals typically get much lower sentences than other people, and therefore that's what Judge Ellis is used to. It comes together with a general sense that federal judges often just don't like particular cases, not along necessarily political lines, but they have very strong opinions about what cases are worthwhile and how they should be prosecuted, and they tend to voice them. So was it a factor? I suspect it was. But was it a driving factor? My experience with federal judges would suggest that it was not. If he was really in the tank for Donald Trump and against the special counsel, then you would have seen something like him granting the motion to dismiss that he denied or doing something to really change the outcome. I mean, instead, he presided over a case that led to conviction on multiple federal felonies.
Unfortunately, all the attorneys and judges involved in the various legal cases that we cover on this show do not always take us into account when scheduling activity in those cases. And so we tape this show on Wednesday mornings, and the sentencing hearing, Paul Manafort's second sentencing hearing, is also happening on Wednesday morning. The sentence was handed down just after we taped the show, so we got Ken to send in this update explaining what the sentence was and why.
Judge Amy Berman Jackson sentenced Paul Manafort to an additional term of 43 months above and beyond what Judge Ellis sentenced him to in the Eastern District of Virginia. How she got there is a little complicated. Remember that he was facing two counts he'd pled guilty to, once for conspiracy to defraud the government and one for conspiracy to tamper with witnesses. She gave him 13 months on the witness tampering count to run consecutively with his Eastern District of Virginia sentence, and 60 months on the conspiracy to commit fraud. And on that one, she made half of it run concurrent and half of it run consecutive. The bottom line is he winds up with a total sentence of 90 months, 7.5 years, of which he'll serve at least 85%, barring changes from some recent changes in the law. It's important to notice that Judge Jackson absolutely blasted Paul Manafort and his lawyers in her sentencing. There was no mention of a blameless life at this sentencing hearing. She made it clear that she believed that their sentencing arguments were wrong and disingenuous, that he had committed persistent fraud, that he was where he was because of his own acts, and that his own lies made it very difficult to evaluate many of his claims. This was not at all a sympathetic judge at a sentencing hearing. But she did give him less than she could have. Judges often depart downwards in white-collar cases. This sentence reflects that even with a judge who is very adamantly opposed to your conduct and not at all a fan, that is still not unusual to get some sort of departure from what the maximum sentence the judge could have gotten. But the criminal justice system wasn't done with Paul Manafort yet. Just moments after Judge Jackson's sentence, Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance announced a state indictment against Manafort, charging him with residential mortgage fraud. The allegations are that Manafort defrauded banks in applying for loans in 2015 and 2016. These new charges will require an entirely new litigation, and one of the issues you should expect to come up is double jeopardy. Whether or not these charges relate to some of the things prosecuted in the federal cases, and if so, does that bar the charges? So, we'll be hearing about Paul Manafort for many more episodes.
Well, that's Paul Manafort. Moving on from that, let's talk about the granddaddy of the lawsuits that launched this show. You remember the lawsuit over the hush agreement with Stormy Daniels suing to get a declaration that she could not be barred from talking about the affair she says she had with President Trump? Well, long-suffering federal judge James Otero has dismissed her claims against the president and Michael Cohen for mootness. Ken, what does that mean?
Well, for some time now, President Trump and Michael Cohen have been trying to get out of this lawsuit. It all started when Stormy Daniels sued them, trying to argue that the hush money agreement was unenforceable for various reasons. And they have now basically conceded that they're not going to enforce it. They promised not to, and obviously they're no longer pursuing her for breaking the hush money agreement. And Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, wanted to continue the fight. He wanted to argue over whether she gets attorney's fees for winning and whether there are other reasons that the hush money agreement is unenforceable. But Judge Otero said no. He said that the main issue in dispute has been resolved, and therefore the court doesn't have jurisdiction anymore. There's nothing for the court to resolve. So away it goes, and what I'm sure is a giant sigh of relief from Judge Otero's chambers.
Michael Avenatti tweeted that this was a victory. The judge said his client had gotten everything she wanted, and that it was ridiculous that people in the media were painting this as though he had lost this motion.
Well, he's got a point, Josh, because the way it's a loss is only if you listen to Michael Avenatti in the first place, which would be foolish. Michael Avenatti very vehemently argued that there were still live issues in the case, that Judge Otero should rule that not only had they decided not to enforce the agreement, they never could have because it was against public policy, and bitterly argued that he was entitled to attorney fees in the case. The judge said no. So he's doing his best to spin, but I think it's a bit beyond his grasp.
So now that this lawsuit is over, we've also learned that Michael Avenatti is not Stormy Daniels' lawyer anymore. She announced that she has a new lawyer, and then Avenatti tweeted explaining that he wasn't fired. He quit being her lawyer for reasons that must remain unspecified due to attorney-client privilege. What do you make of that split?
Well, it's probably been coming for a while. They've had periodic disputes in the past, and she may now be realizing that she could be saddled with a gigantic attorney fee bill for the President of the United States because of her loss of the anti-SLAPP motion on her defamation claim, which Michael Avenatti walked her into.
We'll recall the President got a very large judgment against her. How much was that judgment?
$300,000+.
Right. And so even though Michael Avenatti is the guy who's out in the news being bombastic, it's Stormy Daniels who owes that money to the President now for her attorney's fees. And that was basically Michael Avenatti's legal advice that got her there.
Yes. And the typical move in this type of situation for someone like her would be to consider a malpractice suit against Avenatti for advising her to go this route in the first place and maybe not adequately advising her of the risks of an anti-SLAPP motion.
The problem is ordinarily you want to file a malpractice suit against somebody who has money and could pay you if you won a malpractice case against them. And I think we should discuss another reason that the Daniels-Avenatti relationship may have unraveled, which is Michael Avenatti's financial difficulties. Listeners will recall that Michael Avenatti's old law firm, Egan Avenatti, has been placed in receivership. Egan Avenatti had gone through bankruptcy a little while back, and there was a judgment against the firm for millions of dollars to Jason Frank, who's a former partner in the firm who says he wasn't paid profits that he'd been owed. Then Jason Frank alleged that Michael Avenatti was mismanaging funds, that he was taking money that should have been available to Egan Avenatti, and therefore available to pay Jason Frank, and instead using those funds for things like auto racing. In response to these claims, a court appointed a receiver to oversee the Egan Avenatti firm. Michael Avenatti painted this as no big deal. He said, you know, my new firm, Avenatti & Associates, that's where the action is now anyway. But it really is quite unusual to have any of your law firms placed in receivership. Then, last week, Michael Avenatti filed to put Egan Avenatti in bankruptcy again, which, since there's a receiver, he wasn't supposed to do. It's supposed to be up to the receiver to make decisions, like whether Egan Avenatti will go bankrupt. Jason Frank is obviously very upset about this. He says this is a ploy by Michael Avenatti to avoid what's called a debtor exam, which had been scheduled for this week. And the receiver himself filed a letter with the bankruptcy court saying he told Michael Avenatti that he was not allowed to file bankruptcy for Egan Avenatti, and then he went and did it anyway. Ken, to start, what is a debtor exam, and why might Michael Avenatti have been keen to avoid it?
Well, a debtor exam is a process where someone who has a judgment against you can take your testimony under oath and ask where your assets are, what you own, where it is, how much it's worth, and that type of thing. And it's a tool that creditors use to chase down money from debtors. And the reason Michael Avenatti would have wanted to avoid it is that he would have had to answer questions under oath on behalf of Egan Avenatti about where the firm's assets were and whether it still had them and whether perhaps there was evidence supporting Jason Frank's claim that he diverted them. So this 11th hour filing of a bankruptcy for Egan Avenatti in a way that specifically defies the receivership order, because the order is very clear that only the receiver can consider bankruptcy, really seems like a very blatant stall tactic. And the receiver called it out like that in court papers. The bankruptcy judge, in response to an emergency motion to dismiss the new bankruptcy case, scheduled a hearing for later on the 13th. It'll happen after we record this. And that does not bode well for Mr. Avenatti.
So when you say it doesn't bode well, I mean, this tactic may not work. But also, I mean, should he be worried about criminal liability here?
Yes. So if some of the things that Jason Frank claims are true, and obviously he's someone with a grudge against Avenatti, and we should take them with a grain of salt, some of those things could be bankruptcy fraud. Now, bankruptcy fraud is relatively rarely prosecuted, simply because there's so much of it and so few federal prosecutorial resources. But want to know how you get prosecuted for bankruptcy fraud? You annoy a federal judge or receiver so much that they refer you to the U.S. Attorney's Office and say, put this guy at the head of the line.
So the allegations from Jason Frank, it wasn't just that Avenatti was misusing this money for his personal lifestyle. He also claimed that Avenatti was basically reprioritizing this money in terms of which creditors it would go to in a way that was not allowed by the bankruptcy law. So one of the claims is that he was using these funds that should have gone to Jason Frank in order to pay debts of this coffee chain, Tully's Coffee, that he invested in with the actor Patrick Dempsey, and the investment was not successful. So in that context, I'm thinking back to a few months ago when Stormy Daniels Daniels was having a public feud with her own lawyer, Michael Avenatti, and one of the allegations she made against him was that he was failing to account for funds that had been raised for her legal defense. Then a few days later, she retracted her claim Avenatti had satisfied her that the money was accounted for. Is a risk here that, you know, if you are, as Jason Frank alleges, moving this money around, and then he's trying in court to sort of claw that money back, he can get the money not just from Egan Avenatti and not just from Michael Avenatti, who owns Egan Avenatti, but also conceivably from people that Avenatti paid money to who he wasn't supposed to, right?
Yes, there are all sorts of clawback mechanisms. There are very robust remedies in bankruptcy court. Also, receivers tend to have robust abilities to claw money back that's gone out of the receivership estate. And finally, there are other laws like fraudulent transfer laws that someone like Jason Frank can sue over and go after money that's been moved elsewhere.
Is Michael Avenatti a good lawyer?
Not this week. He is not.
It feels like it's been a while since there was a week where he was a good lawyer.
Well, the basic problem is that being a good lawyer has many parts. So Michael Avenatti is pretty clearly a good courtroom lawyer, and he's pretty clearly capable at motions and papers and that sort of thing. But he is showing atrociously poor judgment, and it's going to bite him soon.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about some even weirder people. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. When Michael Cohen testified before Congress a couple of weeks ago, he testified orally and in writing that, quote, "I never asked for nor would I accept a pardon from President Trump," unquote. But in the last few days, there have been news reports about a team of lawyers that had back-channel conversations on Cohen's behalf about a pardon in early 2018. So this Tuesday, Cohen's lawyer Michael Monaco put out a letter clarifying his client's testimony. Monaco says that when Cohen claimed never to have sought a pardon, that was, quote, "in the context of Cohen's decision to leave the joint defense agreement," unquote, which happened in June of 2018. Monaco allows that Cohen did seek a pardon earlier, though he never discussed it directly with the president. Ken, that is not my understanding of what the word never means.
That's true. And we shouldn't expect Michael Cohen to stop being imprecise, misleading, and generally skeevy just because he's now on this public route to redemption. But it's entirely possible that he did not completely have a grasp of what was going on his behalf. His defense was highly scattered from the very beginning, and it seems as if there were some people asking things on his behalf and other people offering to, as a couple of lawyers have come out of the woodwork saying basically that they approached him, suggesting that they could get him a good deal with the president of the United States. So, you know, to what extent this is one of his more blatant lies as opposed to one of his more carelessnesses, I couldn't tell you.
Wait, no, but he's not claiming to have been unaware about these conversations. In fact, in the letter from Michael Monaco, it says, quote, "Mr. Cohen asked his then attorney to discuss with another Trump attorney possible pardon options consistent with the president's prior public declarations," unquote. So that's him saying there that he told his attorney to seek this pardon.
Well, that's at least the stance he's telling now. So,
right. Isn't that inconsistent with saying I've never asked for nor would I accept a pardon?
Yes. I mean, that's his current stance to back up his heroic redemption arc. A lot of weird stuff was going on during that time period, and we don't know all of the ways Cohen was exploring possible pardons.
But so I guess, is this a perjury risk for Cohen? Because we talked previously about this letter from Republican members of Congress that had a bunch of weak perjury claims. They even said he perjured himself by claiming to have been a good lawyer when he was a bad lawyer. But this seems, could this be something where he could be criminally charged for lying to Congress when he said that he'd never asked for a pardon?
You could present this as perjury to Congress and a violation of the law against lying to Congress. I think because of the context, it would not be the easiest case ever, and it would also be somewhat rubble bouncing. The guy's already convicted felon. He's going to federal prison for 3 years. He's disbarred. And the question would be how much you would get out of an additional perjury prosecution, other than, of course, promoting the narrative that he's a liar and therefore what he says about Trump can't be trusted.
There's some weirdness about the relationship between Cohen and these quasi-lawyers of his through whom he apparently sought this pardon. I want to read some from an ABC News report about Cohen's dealings with these lawyers. Quote, The sources familiar with the contacts said the two lawyers first reached out to Cohen in late April of last year and that the discussions continued for about 2 months. The attorneys, who have no known formal ties to the White House, urged Cohen not to leave the joint defense agreement with the president, the sources told ABC News, and also offered a plan B. In the event that Cohen opted to exit the agreement, these lawyers could join his legal team and act as a conduit between Cohen and the president's lawyers. ABC goes on that according to the sources, the attorneys cautioned Cohen against hiring Guy Petrillo, the former head of the criminal division of the Southern District of New York, saying that could effectively end all contact between Cohen and Trump's legal team. ABC goes on further, the two attorneys never formally joined Cohen's legal team, but sent Cohen a bill for legal services, which he did not pay, the sources said. The charges include fees for at least half a dozen phone calls between the attorneys and Giuliani, according to two sources who have seen the invoice, unquote. So that's really weird, right? Like Cohen ended up hiring Guy Petrillo, and then he had these other lawyers coming to him and basically saying, don't go with that lawyer, go with us. They appear to do something that resembles legal work on his behalf, and then they try to bill him for it, even though he had never engaged them as lawyers.
Well, he never engaged them. He never had an engagement agreement, which is crucial because lawyers need to have a written engagement agreement for things like this. There are two things that could be going on here. One is that it's a genuine overture from Team Trump to try to control him as a witness and to make sure that he either does not flip or that if he does, he remains a conduit of information to the Trump team, as some people say is exactly what happened with Paul Manafort. The other possibility is that these people are just grifters on the make. Whenever there is a high-profile case, it would not be at all unusual for lawyers to come out of the woodwork saying, hey, I have these connections. I can get you in with Rudy. I can, you know, get the pardon from the president. I have all these great ideas about what you should do. So it may be down to the lawyers gunning for the case as opposed to an actual Trump overture. But I'd say both are plausible.
Cohen is also suing the Trump Organization, saying that they breached their agreement to cover his legal fees, which one would assume are quite extensive by now. Is he likely to be able to force the Trump Organization to pay his legal bills?
Maybe some of them. So he is claiming both contractual rights and implied contractual rights because he was acting when he did all these things that got him in trouble as a lawyer for the Trump Organization. And he claims that he has a contractual right to indemnity, to have them pay for any legal services he needs as a result of his work. And yes, he's demanding to be paid not just for the civil cases, like the Stormy Daniels case, but for his criminal defense and for his representation at his testimony before Congress. There are a few complicating factors, though, and one is that it's generally difficult to be indemnified, covered for criminal acts. In some jurisdictions, it's against the law to do it. And the Trump Organization may have robust defenses that, in effect, look, you went way outside the line. You committed crimes. That's not something we have to indemnify you for. There will be any number of other equitable defenses as well. So it will be quite an interesting fight. One problem with it will be that during that fight, Michael Cohen will be in federal prison, which makes it somewhat more difficult to pursue his case.
Okay, let's talk about the conspiracy theorists who are suing each other. You have Jerome Corsi, who's the guy who popularized the birther conspiracy theory about Barack Obama, and you have his gadfly lawyer, Larry Klayman. They were already suing Roger Stone. Now they're suing Alex Jones and InfoWars, claiming that Jones and other hosts on the conspiracy network defamed them on their shows. For example, they accused Klayman of being a bad lawyer and, quote, a piece of garbage. They accused Corsi of being a drunk and a perjurer. I guess before we should get into the legal merits of these claims, we should talk about why these former friends aren't getting along. These used to be conspiracy theory buddies. They would, you know, go and have conversations with each other about all the things that were causing them to wear tinfoil on their heads. And now it seems they're having a dispute about who has said what because both Roger Stone and Jerome Corsi are in legal jeopardy over whether they made false statements to the special counsel.
This is really part two of the dispute between Corsi and Roger Stone. It's just another expression of that lawsuit and that argument, because most of what goes on in this lawsuit are statements by Stone on InfoWars or statements riffing on what Stone said. And they really reflect this basic fight about whether or not Corsi is in any federal criminal legal jeopardy as a result of the investigation.
So let's talk about these defamation claims. Are any of them strong? I mean, some of them seem ridiculous. It can't be defamatory to call somebody garbage because that's an opinion. I don't think you can defame Jerome Corsi by calling him dishonest because he is dishonest. This is the guy who invented birtherism. So it seems like if you call him dishonest, that's true, and it's also not damaging to his reputation because he's already known as somebody who's dishonest.
Remember, as we've talked about many times before, to have something be defamatory, it has to be a provably false statement of fact, not opinion. And in determining whether something is fact or opinion, the judge looks at the perspective of a person familiar with the context, with the speaker and the platform they're using. So the question is, would any reasonable person familiar with InfoWars take the things said there as statements of fact? Which I guess raises the question of whether a reasonable person would be familiar with InfoWars in the first place. So most of this stuff is clear opinion under any standard. Saying that Corsi is demented, saying that Klayman is garbage, all this stuff is clear insult and outside the bounds of fact. There are a few statements, though, that are potentially defamatory. There are a few accusations of lying in specific instances that could potentially be defamatory, and maybe one or two accusations of dishonest behavior that are specific and factual enough to make it. But as a whole, it's a frivolous suit. It's a very clearly attack on someone else's trash-talking you.
What about the part where he says he's going on about Klayman being a bad lawyer, and he says that Klayman has never won a case? Which is not true. Klayman actually sued his former employer, Judicial Watch, for defamation and won. So could that be defamatory if you don't just say, oh, this guy sucks at lawyering, but like he, you know, he's never won when in fact he has?
Sure, it could be defamatory. The trick is always how far you can push a case. You know, if you're as the defendant, you want to knock out these things as non-defamatory as early as possible. But you have to then answer, if you do get past that point, what are the possible damages from this? I mean, how is Larry Klayman damaged by lunatics on InfoWars saying things like that about him? It's not like someone on InfoWars was going to hire him for a big case. So, you know, I think he would have real trouble convincing a jury that it was defamatory or getting any significant amount of damages, but some of those are allegations that might survive the initial stages of the case.
Well, except that the conspiracy theory industry is a core industry and audience for these people, and in fact, one of the claims in this lawsuit is a Lanham Act unfair competition claim, basically saying that, you know, both Jerome Corsi and InfoWars and Roger Stone, they're all in this business of basically blathering on about nonsense to credulous people. And that by saying that Corsi is dishonest, you have unfair competition by InfoWars, basically saying, don't go Jerome Corsi for your nonsense. Come here for your nonsense. Is that a valid claim?
No. I mean, the Lanham Act doesn't mean keep your name out of my mouth. That's not what it does. And, you know, if they could show real income that is being wrongfully diverted by, you know, taking over their brand or something like that, that would be another thing. But most of the people who watch and consume this stuff are lunatics and not customers. And I think he's going to have a very difficult time showing any sort of damage arising from this.
There's so much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW or on Facebook, too. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Tadim Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.